PSAs for us, and even more. Reach out to our programming manager, Alex Fernandez, via email at programs@cfrc.ca for more information, or visit our website at cfrc.ca/volunteer and sign up today.
This ain't Monkey Wrench by Foo Fighters. This isn't actually an ad for my new show. You want to join me, Zach, every Saturday at 8 p.m. for your favorite 90s hits, throwbacks, and deep cuts. We'll be playing you songs like this all night from 8 to 9 p.m. So join me as I take you to the 90s.
What's up? It's Pickles. We have a message.
Let's have a kiki. Get ready for a fabulous time with dragshow.ca. From drag brunches to holiday cabarets, there's something for everyone. Check out the latest events and join in the fun. Visit dragshow.ca for all the details.
We are going to serve
and work and turn
and honey.
Is Democracy Now!
I think at a certain point you have to start looking at what do you do when you have a rogue judge. The judge that we're talking about, you look at his other rulings, I mean, rulings unrelated, but having to do with me, he's a lunatic.
The United States is facing a constitutional crisis as President Trump escalates his attacks on federal judges, as the White House suffers new legal setbacks. On Tuesday, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts rebuked Trump's call to impeach judges who rule against the White House. We'll get the latest. Then we go to Colorado, where ICE agents have detained a prominent immigrant rights activist, Jeanette Vizgueta. She was once named Time's 100 Most Influential list. She was named to that list. She was able to call in to supporters from detention outside.
I'm hopeful I'm going to be able to leave here and continue my fighting for others, because inside here there are many injustices.
We'll also look at the Trump administration's efforts to sabotage Social Security. And we'll get an update on Gaza as Israel launches a new wave of airstrikes, shattering the nearly two-month-old ceasefire. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel continued its relentless attacks across the Gaza Strip overnight, killing at least 27 Palestinians one day after Israel unilaterally withdrew from the Gaza ceasefire and launched massive new strikes. At least five international aid workers were rushed to Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah after they were injured in an Israeli airstrike that targeted a United Nations facility. The group Defense for Children denounced the massacre of at least 174 children by Israeli forces on Tuesday, calling it, quote, one of the largest one-day child death tolls in Gaza's history. Defense for Children Palestine wrote in a statement, quote, Israeli forces have signed a death warrant for Palestinian children in Gaza as they carry out nonstop attacks, continue to destroy civilian infrastructure and prevent any humanitarian aid from reaching Palestinians in need. This is nothing short of a genocide, they said. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said he's outraged by the new wave of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza that have killed well over 400 people since Monday. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened the latest bombardment campaign on Gaza is only the beginning and said all future ceasefire talks will now take place under fire. Families of the remaining and recently released hostages have joined protests urging Netanyahu to return to the negotiating table. Protests broke out around the world Tuesday, condemning Israel's renewed bombardment of Gaza, shattering the ceasefire agreement with Hamas. Here in New York, hundreds of protesters gathered in Times Square Tuesday. Democracy Now! Was there. This is Isabella Titi of the Palestinian Youth Movement.
I think our movement is only growing. More and more people are conscious about what's happening in Palestine and the attack that we're feeling right now in the U.S. on our First Amendment rights is showing us that the U.S. is willing to do anything in order to protect its relationship with Israel, and it will not be met with silence.
Mahmoud Khalil has called himself a political prisoner in his first direct remarks to the public since federal immigration agents arrested him without a warrant on March 8th in Columbia University housing. In a letter dictated over the phone from an ICE jail in Jena, Louisiana, Mahmoud Khalil decried his arrest, anti-Palestinian racism by both the Biden and Trump administrations, and the inhumane conditions faced by immigrant detainees. His open letter reads, quote, "My arrest was a direct consequence of exercising my right to free speech as I advocated for a free Palestine and an end to the genocide in Gaza. While I await legal decisions that hold the futures of my wife and child in the balance, those who enabled my targeting remain comfortably at Columbia University, knowing fully that this moment transcends my individual circumstances. I hope nonetheless to be free to witness the birth of my firstborn child," unquote. Mahmoud Khalil is a green card holder. His wife, Noor Abdullah, is a U.S. citizen who's 8 months pregnant. Khalil's legal team has filed a motion with a federal court in New York asking for his immediate release. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts issued a rare statement Tuesday rebuking President Trump and his allies for their calls to impeach federal judges who rule against the administration. Roberts wrote, quote, "For more than two centuries, it's been established that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision. The normal appellate review process exists for that purpose," unquote. Roberts' statement came after Trump repeatedly attacked U.S. District Judge James Boasberg, who ordered the Trump administration to stop using the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to deport immigrants. On social media, President Trump called Boasberg a, quote, "radical left lunatic of a judge and a troublemaker and an agitator." Numerous Trump officials have openly threatened to defy court orders. Meanwhile, Judge Boasberg has accused the administration of adopting an approach of, quote, "we don't care, we'll do what we want," unquote. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. In Colorado, dozens of people gathered for a rally Tuesday evening demanding the release of longtime immigrant rights leader Jeanette Vizguerra, who was ambushed during a work break on Monday and taken into custody by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. She's now being jailed at an ICE detention center in Aurora, run by the private prison company Geo Group. In a phone call from inside detention, Vizguerra shared this message with supporters who held a vigil outside the ICE jail in the freezing rain Tuesday.
"I want you to know I'm not going to surrender. I'm going to keep fighting. And even if they remove me, I'm going to continue doing binational work. And they are not going to silence my voice."
Jeanette Vizguerra drew national attention in 2017 when she took sanctuary in a Denver church, along with her four children, three of whom are U.S.-born, to avoid deportation. She's lived in the United States for nearly 30 years, since leaving Mexico City in 1997 with her husband and her then six-year-old daughter. Denver Mayor Mike Johnston condemned her arrest as a Putin-style persecution of political dissidents. Later in the broadcast, we'll go to Colorado to speak with Jeanette Vizguerra's daughter, Luna Baez. Russia's military launched fresh attacks on Ukraine overnight, firing dozens of drones toward the capital and bombing the eastern city of Sumy, where a drone strike on a hospital forced the evacuation of more than 100 patients. Meanwhile, Russian officials said a Ukrainian drone attack triggered a fire at an oil terminal in the southern region of Krasnodar. The violence came just hours after Russia said President Vladimir Putin had agreed to pause attacks on energy targets temporarily during a two-hour phone call with President Trump. According to the Kremlin, Putin declined to endorse a full 30-day ceasefire and emphasized any deal is contingent on the U.S. and its allies halting all military aid and intelligence to Ukraine. The Kremlin's readout of the call directly contradicts this comment by President Trump on Fox News.
We didn't talk about aid, actually. We didn't talk about aid at all. We talked about a lot of things, but aid was never discussed.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he would likely support the new, more limited ceasefire, though he was waiting for more information about it. Zelensky scheduled to speak by phone with Trump later today. Meanwhile, Germany's outgoing government has agreed to send an additional 3 billion euros worth of military aid to Ukraine. Germany's defense minister blasted Trump's agreement with Putin, saying it counts for nothing, and said Trump would have to win greater concessions. A federal judge in Maryland ruled Tuesday that Elon Musk's unilateral efforts to dismantle the U.S. Agency for International Development are likely unconstitutional in multiple ways. U.S. District Judge Theodore Chuang ordered Musk's so-called Department of Government Efficiency to reinstate computer and email access to current USAID workers and bars DOGE from taking further action. However, it's not clear whether the ruling will have any impact on reopening USAID after the Trump administration effectively shuttered the agency. President Trump blasted Judge Chuang's ruling and promised an appeal, telling Fox News, quote, "We have rogue judges that are destroying our country," unquote. President Trump's fired the 2 Democratic-appointed commissioners on the Federal Trade Commission in a direct challenge to a 90-year-old Supreme Court ruling protecting independent government agencies. Trump's order terminating Alvaro Bedoya and Rebecca Kelly Slaughter leaves the FTC with just 2 Republican-appointed commissioners, short of the 3 needed to form a quorum to perform many of the agency's functions. In a statement, Alvaro Bedoya said, quote, "The FTC is an independent agency founded 111 years ago to fight fraudsters and monopolists. Our staff is unafraid of the Martin Shkreli's and the Jeff Bezoses of the world. They take them to court and they win. Now the president wants the FTC to be a lapdog for his golfing buddies. I'll see the president in court," Bedoya added. Delaware Senate has approved a bill that would shield corporations from shareholder accountability in a state where 2/3 of all Fortune 500 companies are registered. The legislation is backed by Democratic Governor Matt Meyer and was written by the law firm that represents Tesla and Elon Musk. The bill would make it harder for shareholders to access internal corporate documents and communications and would give corporations more protections from shareholder lawsuits and conflict of interest cases. A Delaware House committee is voting today on the legislation, which critics have condemned as the billionaire's bill. If approved, it'll restore Elon Musk's 2018 CEO pay package at Tesla, worth $56 billion, the largest ever for a publicly traded corporation, before it was voided by a Delaware judge following a shareholder lawsuit. Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwandan President Paul Kagame have called for an immediate ceasefire in the eastern DRC following peace talks in Doha mediated by Qatar's government. They were the first direct talks between the nations since Rwanda-backed M23 fighters seized 2 major cities in the eastern DRC earlier this year in a major offensive that left 7,000 people dead. Tuesday's talks in Qatar came after M23 representatives backed out of scheduled peace talks in Angola's capital. Turkish police have arrested Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu on what his supporters say are trumped-up corruption charges ahead of primary elections scheduled for Sunday. İmamoğlu is a major challenger to Turkey's authoritarian president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. In 2022, he was found guilty of insulting public officials and sentenced to prison, but has remained free pending an appeal. Turkish police also arrested 100 other people, including one of İmamoğlu's close aides. Authorities have also closed roads around Istanbul and banned protests in the city for 4 days while restricting access to social media sites. And Hungary's parliament has approved a bill banning LGBTQ plus pride events and allowing law enforcement to use facial recognition technology to identify people who violate the ban. The new law was backed by Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his far-right populist party. As lawmakers voted Tuesday, opposition MPs set off rainbow-colored smoke bombs inside parliament. Amnesty International said in a statement, quote, "The spurious justification for the passing of this law, that events and assemblies would be harmful to children, is based on harmful stereotypes and deeply entrenched discrimination, homophobia, and transphobia, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Gaza, where the nearly two-month ceasefire has been shattered by Israel as it carries out a second day of intense airstrikes. At least 27 Palestinians were killed in overnight strikes. This comes a day after Israel killed over 400 Palestinians, including at least 174 children. The Group Defense for Children said it was, quote, one of the largest one-day child death tolls in Gaza's history. On Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, quote, this is just the beginning, unquote. The attacks come as Israel continues to block food, aid and fuel into the Gaza Strip. We go now to Mohammed Shahada in Copenhagen. He's a writer and analyst from Gaza, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Mohammed, thanks so much for joining us. Can you describe what's happening right now in Gaza?
Thanks so much, Amy, for having me. It's basically the most unprecedented, most savage attack that Gaza has witnessed in over a year. You have about 200 kids whose lives was extinguished in the matter of seconds, and now you have about 700 wounded civilians that are languishing in hospitals that are dysfunctional because of the Israeli genocide in Gaza. There's, for example, a girl that is about 6 years old, Eileen Abuzouz, who has an apple-sized shrapnel stuck in her chest, and doctors are trying to race against time to remove it to save her life. Doctors are saying that Palestinians that were wounded in those airstrikes in critical condition are under a death sentence because there's no capacity whatsoever. You have entire families that were extinguished completely, a whole bloodline that vanished from the civil registry. So I have a colleague whose sister, her husband, their kids, their in-laws and their grandchildren were killed in a single airstrike. And the viciousness of all of this is compounded by the fact that there was not a single Hamas militant that was hit in that airstrike, not a single Hamas militant that was declared dead. The most prominent figures that were killed in those airstrikes were basically four government officials, the acting prime minister, the acting minister of interior, the acting minister of justice, and the head of the internal security agency. What Israel is doing there has nothing to do with Hamas whatsoever. It's been made clear by Israeli officials yesterday who said that basically whoever thinks that those attacks will make Hamas more flexible is completely blind, is missing the point. The attack was completely predictable. You had the Israeli journalist Ori Misgav in Haaretz saying a couple of hours before Israel killed those 460 people in Gaza, he said that Netanyahu is about to attack Gaza because the walls are closing in on him. He had a bunch of crises, a national crisis having to do with his attempt to fire the attorney general, the head of the Shin Bet, a crisis in terms of passing the budget. It was about to falter. There was a crisis about his corruption trial testimony that was scheduled yesterday, and he was trying to get it canceled. And there was another crisis about basically the demonstrations that were scheduled in Jerusalem yesterday in protest of all of this. So the Israeli right-wing government always goes through the same dynamic. When you're in crisis, nothing would unite your government. Nothing would suppress any sort of protest or opposition more than killing Palestinians, than destroying Palestinians and sort of parading their pain and misery on TV. There was another dimension. So as soon as the airstrikes unfolded in Gaza, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the extremist far-right Israeli former minister of police, he rejoined Netanyahu's government in convenient time to pass the budget. The other dimension is that Netanyahu is trying to kill the Egyptian-Arab plan for Gaza's early recovery and reconstruction without any mass transfer of the population there. There was an Egyptian major conference, international conference for Gaza's reconstruction scheduled in April, and there were reports that Trump gave sort of an initial approval to the Egyptian plan with a lot of inquiries and questions about it. So by resuming the genocide in Gaza, you get all these things off the table. It's insane that they're getting away with it. It's even more insane how mainstream media is covering it up and manufacturing consent for the resumption of a genocide.
And Mohammed, I wanted to ask you about the reaction of the West on this. There was a UN Security Council meeting where Britain, France, and Russia all condemned the new bombings, but no resolution. The United States representative defending Israel, its attacks on Gaza.
The reaction was absolutely underwhelming. 400 people killed in Gaza. That is Gaza's own October 7th. There's been way more kids that were killed in Gaza, over 200, compared to October 7th, where 36 were killed. The reaction of the international community is absolutely disappointing and shameful. But there's another dimension to it. As you said, like the most you would get is basically expressions of concern or condemnation without any action whatsoever. And European Union leaders have made this to us clear behind closed doors over the last year, where they said that 80% of European governments are okay with Israel doing whatever it wants in Gaza, are okay with giving this carte blanche. The other dimension is you have a Trump administration now willing to give Israel the heaviest bombs in its arsenal, the 2,000-pound bombs that as soon as it's used, it creates a fireball of 3,500 degrees Fahrenheit, and it kills people within the radius of 350 meters. And now Israel is raining those on Gaza again like candy, with a White House that is willing to whitewash Israel's genocide in Gaza in real time. It's absolutely insane and shameful what's going on in this regard, and even more shameful how it's being covered up, how Israel is being given the benefit of the doubt. So you see it in headlines where basically it says that that number of people in Gaza were killed despite the ceasefire. It does not call that actively call out Israel for violating, destroying, obliterating the ceasefire.
And is it your sense that that Netanyahu and the Trump administration are now seriously continuing to entertain the idea of removing Palestinians from Gaza?
Yes, absolutely, especially for Netanyahu. It immediately brought Ben-Gvir to the government, who's been actively calling for depopulating Gaza. You have other ministers on record, like Bezalel Smotrich, calling for the same thing and even openly saying that the IDF will create or is creating now a division that is actively looking for countries to take Palestinians. There is the other dimension. Israel never, never, never respects a ceasefire with Palestinians whatsoever. It's been the same dynamic over and over again. My late friend Rifat Al-Har'ir put it best. He said a ceasefire is basically when Palestinians cease and Israel continues to fire. Israel's defense minister and former prime minister and former defense minister Ehud Barak, he put it after Operation Kastlit 2008. He said as soon as the ceasefire is signed, nobody's going to bother with the details. So as soon as the ceasefire in Gaza was signed, you had Israel killing over 150 civilians in the course of over a month. You had Israel, like, can you imagine if a single Israeli was scratched, let alone killed, a soldier or a civilian during the ceasefire, how all hell would have broken loose on Palestinians? It shows how Palestinians are basically the most self-restrained people on the face of the earth, that Israel has killed over now 700 people in the course of the ceasefire without a single bullet being fired from Gaza. It shows how Gazans are sort of desperate, keen, very much persistent to end the war, whereas Israel is sort of salivating for a carnage. Israel was allowing into Gaza about 10% of the tents that were allowed to go, that were supposed to go in, 30% of the fuel that's necessary to run hospitals and sewage treatment plants and water infrastructure. They were basically preventing people from leaving for medical treatment, restricting the number of people that are allowed to leave. They violated it in every single way along the way of the last over 40 days or 50 days in order to provoke a Palestinian reaction that points the finger and says, look, Palestinians are the ones that don't want a ceasefire. It's insane. But like Israel never even started the negotiations of phase two of the ceasefire in the first place that was scheduled on February 6th. And now what you have with the Israelis is basically you had a channel between Trump's envoy for hostage negotiations, Adam Boehler, with Hamas, that managed to produce a preliminary outline that would see a truce in Gaza for 5 to 10 years, Hamas laying down their arms, a new government in Gaza. You would see hostage negotiations and hostage release. Israel's reaction was to immediately leak it to the media, torpedo the talks, and get Adam Boehler's confirmation or nomination revoked before it was even confirmed in the Senate. So you see who is very desperate for this war to go on forever.
Mohammed Shahada, we want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian writer and analyst from Gaza, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, speaking to us from Copenhagen. Coming up, the United States is facing a constitutional crisis as President Trump escalates his attacks on federal judges, as the White House suffers legal setback after legal setback. Stay with us.
To be in America, okay by me in America. Everything's free in America, for us more free in America. Automobiles in America, from me I'm still in America. Wires for wheels in America, very big deal in America. I like the city of San Juan. I know a boat you can get on. Everyone there will get big cheer. Everyone there will have moved here.
America by Trini Lopez. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we look at the Trump administration undermining Social Security. And also, we go to Aurora, Colorado, where a leading immigrant rights activist has been jailed. But first, we talk about the Supreme Court. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Supreme Court Justice John Roberts has issued a rare statement Tuesday criticizing calls by President Trump and his allies to impeach federal judges that rule against him. Chief Justice Roberts wrote, quote, "For more than two centuries, it's been established that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision. The normal appellate review process exists for that purpose," unquote. Chief Justice Roberts' statement came after Trump repeatedly attacked U.S. District Judge, that's Federal Judge James Boasberg, who ordered the Trump administration to stop using the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to deport immigrants. It has only been used three times before in U.S. history, and those times during war. On Saturday, the administration ignored Boasberg's order to turn around three deportation flights bound for a maximum security, privately run prison in El Salvador. One social media post Trump called for the impeachment of Boasberg, who he described as, quote, radical left lunatic of a judge and a troublemaker and an agitator. Now, this is a federal judge who ordered the release of Hillary Clinton's emails, just to give you a sense of who Boasberg is. Numerous Trump officials have openly threatened to defy court orders. This is Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, speaking on Fox News.
I'm proud to be a part of this administration. We're not stopping. I don't care what the judges think. I don't care what the left thinks. We're coming.
White House advisor Stephen Miller appeared on CNN Monday and said Judge Boasberg has no authority to make his ruling on the 1798 Alien Enemies Act.
This judge violated the law. He violated the Constitution.
So again, so
he defied the system of government that we have in this country.
During a hearing on Monday, Judge Boasberg accused the administration of adopting an approach of, quote, "We don't care, we'll do what we want," unquote. This all comes as the Trump administration continues to face more setbacks in court. On Monday, a federal judge blocked President Trump's transgender military ban. Another federal judge ruled Elon Musk's efforts to dismantle USAID likely violated the Constitution in multiple ways. Trump responded to the Musk ruling on Fox News.
We will be appealing it. We have rogue judges that are destroying our country.
As fears of a constitutional crisis grow, we're joined by Elie Mystal, the nation's justice correspondent. His new piece is headlined, "Trump is trying to create his own personal legal strike force." Elie's also author of the upcoming book, Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America. Elie, thanks for coming back to Democracy Now! What is happening right now with this presidential attack on judges?
We live in a fascist dictatorship.
That's what's happening right now. That's what it feels like. This is where we are. There's not a coming constitutional crisis. We are in the constitutional crisis right now. Because what do we have? How can we call ourselves a democracy? How can we call ourselves a nation of laws if one man and one man alone, Donald Trump, is able to defy the other two branches of government? And that's what we have here. And that's what Trump is promising, promised to do, and that's what he is, in fact, doing. Amy, you played the clip. You mentioned John Roberts' statement, and you rightly pointed out that it is rare for John Roberts to say anything at all. But let's look at what the man said, and let's look at what the man didn't say, right? It was one of the weakest statements that he could have possibly made. He's running around with his, clutching his pearls over, like, don't impeach federal judges, that's wrong. Can't say nothing about actually following the orders given by those federal judges that Roberts doesn't want impeached, right? Didn't say anything about Trump's blatant violation of multiple federal court orders. He didn't say anything about that at all. So again, Roberts is not your friend. Roberts is not the one coming to help us. He's as afraid as I believe that Roberts is as afraid of Trump as the rest of the government is. And that's, again, I don't know any definition of fascist dictatorship other than the one we are all experiencing right now.
And Elliot, in terms of the qualitative difference between the current situation and past confrontations between the executive branch and the courts, of course, back in the 1800s, there was a famous battle between Andrew Jackson and the Supreme Court over the relative sovereignty of the Native American peoples, and FDR had his conflicts with the courts. But this is, as you say, multiple federal judges all around the country coming up ruling against the Trump administration. What's your sense of the difference between this and all prior historical battles?
Well, here, the Trump administration is directly saying, you just played that ghoul, Stephen Miller, directly saying that the federal judges don't have authority over this administration. Right? So that's number one. That's the biggest break from the past. They're not even pretending to acknowledge the authority of the federal judiciary to restrain or control this administration, right? So that's number one. Number two, when you look at those historical examples, you're talking for the most part about military funding, right? You're talking about, Andrew Jackson saying the judges made his order, now let him enforce it, as he's committing genocide against the Native Americans. You're talking about Teddy Roosevelt sending the Navy halfway out into the Pacific and saying, like, Congress, I'm sure you will fund them to bring them back, won't you? You're talking about the executive branch executing its large control, the commander in chief exercising his large control over the American military. This ain't that, all right? This isn't a military situation. This is Congress appointed money for USAID, put the money back on, turn the money back on, and Trump saying, no, I ain't. Absolutely not. This is the judge saying, turn the planes around and bring those people back, and Trump saying, nope, won't do that either. This is straight up, again, this is straight up authoritarianism. This is straight up one man's and one man's whim alone controls the country. As you played, you've got his border czar out there literally saying he's not going to respect judicial opinions. You've got Stephen Miller saying that. You've got Trump saying that. And that's what's different from the past. If anybody thinks that there's a equivalency here, I'd like to just remind people that I am old enough to remember when the Supreme Court unconstitutionally, in my mind, outlawed abortions. I'm old enough to remember that. I'm old enough to remember President Joe Biden not going into Texas and being like, abortions for everybody, right? I remember Joe Biden respecting the Supreme Court's ridiculous order when it came to a woman's right to choose. And so I would just contrast Biden's restraint when it came to judges versus what we're seeing from the Trump administration.
I also wanted to ask you about Trump's weaponizing of the Justice Department, even though he claims the Justice Department was weaponized against him. In his speech last week at the Great Hall at the Justice Department, he said, quote, as the chief law enforcement officer in our country, I will insist upon and demand full and complete accountability for the wrongs and abuses that have occurred. he was there with the head of the FBI, Kash Patel, and Attorney General Pam Biondi in attendance.
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, this is Trump doing what he promised to do. This is a dictator acting like a dictator, right? This is a man personally taking control of the law enforcement apparatus of the United States to go after his political enemies. That's what he promised to do. That is, in fact, what he's doing. I'm surprised people are surprised. What'd you think the man was going to do? Follow the law? He didn't even promise to do that. So, like, why are people surprised that he's not doing it now, right? He went to the DOJ. And look, Juan, to be clear, I don't have any pearls to clutch. I'm not one of these people who's like, oh, my God, he talked to the attorney general. Why? Even though, if we're going to look historically, there is supposed to be a wall of separation between the DOJ and the president of the United States. Again, to go back to Joe Biden, he wouldn't even call Merrick Garland to follow up on whether or not he was doing anything about the people who attacked the Capitol on January 6th. But putting that aside, Trump went to the DOJ to declare, to announce, to confirm that he intends to use the Department of Justice to go after his political enemies, especially the lawyers. Trump called out a number of lawyers during that speech, Jack Smith, Andrew Weissman, Norm Eisen, specifically saying that he is going to use his lawyers at the DOJ because they're his now, not ours. They work for him, not the people of the United States of America. Trump made that entirely clear. He's going to use his lawyers to go after the lawyers he believes stand up and oppose him. That was the upshot of his speech at the Department of Justice. And what did Pam Bondi do? What did Kash Patel do? They sat there and they clapped like seals. They clap like the good little sycophants they are, and we can assume that they will carry out Trump's unlawful, lawless orders to bring political prosecutions against the lawyers that Trump believes oppose him. He said at one point during that speech, CNN and MSDNC write 97.6% bad about me. Grammatically, that's normal Trump, but politically and legally, he's saying that you should be able to go after the media for writing bad things about him. Again, if this isn't authoritarianism, if this isn't dictatorship, if this isn't fascism, then I don't know what those words mean.
So, Ellie Mistel, I wanted to ask you about the judge's rulings that the administration directly defied. You have the case of the detainees being sent to El Salvador, to a supermax prison, when the judge directly said, turn those planes around, and there was one still on the tarmac. And you have the case of Dr. Rasha Alawiya, the Brown University professor, the kidney specialist. Another judge said she is not to be deported. They deported her anyway. If you can respond to these two cases, and then the case of Mahmoud Khalil, who is now calling himself a political prisoner. He's in an ICE detention facility in Jena, Louisiana. He was one of those who protested the U.S. support for the Israeli war on Gaza. Can you talk about all of this?
So, Amy, people have told me from the jump, from November 5th when he was elected, that the courts would save us, that the courts would restrain him, that the courts would be the final guardrail preventing his military dictatorship. And I have said from the jump that the courts will not save us, that they cannot save us because they cannot enforce their own decisions. The executive enforces the court's decisions. And if you have an executive like Trump who is willing to ignore court orders, then there's nothing courts can do. So part of my question, Amy, is to turn it around back on the other people who were telling me for months that the courts would save us. What do y'all got now? What's your plan now? Now that the courts have issued their order and Trump has ignored their orders, what's plan B? Because plan A was the courts saving us, and that was never going to work. My response to Trump violating a court order, violating multiple court orders, is the people have to lead because the courts will not do it. The courts cannot do it. You want to free Khalil? We need to go to Jenna and free Khalil. Like, that's what it takes. It's not going to happen because a judge writes something down on a piece of paper. Trump is just going to ignore it. And we saw that with the Venezuelans that he deported illegally after a court told him to turn the plane around. And we saw it with the doctor who we deported what he said too quickly for the courts to rule at all. And again, I'll turn it back on John Roberts, who didn't say boo about that, right? Had all the smoke for like, oh, don't impeach my judges. Didn't say boo about Trump refusing to turn the planes around under a direct court order to do so. This is the fascism we are living under. This is what it feels like, folks.
I want to thank you so much, Ellie, for being with us. Ellie Mistel is the nation's justice correspondent. We will link to your latest article. Trump is trying to create his own personal legal strike force. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Colorado, ICE agents, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, have detained the prominent immigrant rights activist Jeanette Vizgueta. The agents picked her up at a Denver-area Target where she worked. She's now being held in an ICE detention center in Aurora that's run by the private prison company Geo Group. Jeanette Vizgueta gained national attention in 2017 when she took sanctuary at a Denver church along with her four children, three of whom are U.S. born, to avoid deportation. Time magazine named her one of the 100 most influential people in 2017. She's lived in the United States for almost 30 years, since leaving Mexico City in 1997 with her husband and her then six-year-old daughter. On Tuesday, her supporters gathered outside the ICE jail in the freezing rain where she's being held, and she called into the rally.
Jeanette, te queremos tanto, tanto, tanto. Aquí estamos por ti.
Thank you. I want you to know I'm not going to surrender. I'm going to keep fighting. And even if they remove me, I'm going to continue doing binational work. And they are not going to silence my voice.
Okay. Okay, everybody. Jeanette is on the phone right now. What do we have to say to her?
We love you, Jeanette.
We're here for you. Free Jeanette.
Estamos aquí.
Estamos contigo. Sé fuerte.
Fuerza, Jeanette.
Thank you to everyone that is there. I really thank you for all the time you have been by my side during these 16 years we've been fighting. I'm hopeful I'm going to be able to leave here and continue my fighting for others, because inside here there are many injustices. There are a lot of women that their cases are not being reviewed, and I'm going to try to help them, even being here in detention.
That was the immigrant rights activist Jeanette Vizgueta calling from an ICE jail hours after she was detained, and her voice was on speakerphone to those who'd gathered to support her outside, the phone being held by her daughter. We're joined now by two guests, Jennifer Piper, Program Director at American Friends Service Committee, Colorado, doing coordination support for Jeanette, and Luna Baez Vizgueta, the 21-year-old daughter of Jeanette, who is holding that phone outside the ICE jail. Now, let's remember, this is Aurora, Colorado. Aurora, Colorado, and Springfield, Ohio, were what Trump, when running for president, promised would be ground zero for deportations. I want to start with Jennifer. What's happening here? I mean, we know the case of Jeanette Vizgueta so well over the years, went into the Denver church where she had taken sanctuary. Why has she been targeted now?
Good morning. Yeah, there is no reason for her to be targeted right now in terms of legally. The administration doesn't have a valid deportation order, and their act to try and remove her this week violates her due process rights. You know, in terms of any other reason why they might be targeting Jeanette, she's long been a leader since she arrived to the United States in 1997. She began union organizing. She joined an immigrant rights organization. She was the first person in the country, among the first, to make her deportation case public in 2009 and really expose the machinery and the cruelty of our deportation machine, which is vast in the United States. And no matter who the administration was, Jeanette has always stood and will continue to stand for justice and for dignity for all people.
And do you think that she was targeted because of her advocacy?
I mean, it seems possible in this environment. We're still hopeful that Immigration and Customs Enforcement will recognize their error and reinstate her due process rights within the immigration system. Her lawyer has filed a habeas and also a motion at the district court, at the circuit court, excuse me, the 10th Circuit Court, to review her case. And so we're hopeful that immigration will come to the table.
Bring Luna Baez Vizgueta into the conversation. Luna, you're 21. I remember you years ago when we were covering Jeanette in the church. Now, you were standing outside yesterday in the freezing rain, holding up that cell phone so your mother could be heard. You have said that your mother had noticed unmarked vehicles following her for the past few days when she was leaving work and when she was on break. Can you talk about that and what your fears are right now? I mean, the mayor of Denver has called for her to be released.
I would say in regards to kind of the unmarked vehicles, it's something that is very, very scary. It's something that she's always very vigilant because obviously in her circumstances, there's a lot to be worried about, especially just regarding documentation status. And it comes to find out that there were also some people with out uniforms that were kind of watching her from inside the store and that they were just waiting for her to go on break to be able to make their arrest.
I want to go back to 2017 when I interviewed Jeanette Vizgueta inside the First Unitarian Society, the Church of Denver, where she had taken refuge.
Are you prepared for ICE to come in at any time?
Yes, we have an internal plan here at the church, and not only at this church, also at the church where Ingrid is, who is at the other church in Mountain View. She has been in sanctuary for over 3 months. Both churches are part of the Metro Denver Sanctuary Coalition, and each church has its own emergency plan. I am also prepared. Before coming here, I prepared a family plan in case ICE were to go to my house. Part of the plan with my children was that one of them would be filming and the other one would be calling people from a list that I gave them. And here, we have a similar plan. So I am prepared, and so are the people here. We hope that Donald Trump will respect these spaces. It would look wrong from a moral standpoint if he came after mothers who are just fighting for their families.
So that's Jeanette Vizgueta back in 2017 during Trump 1, the first Trump administration, terrified that she would be removed from her children. As we wrap up, Jennifer Piper, what is the plan right now?
Yeah, so over her entire case, her entire fight of the last 16 years, every moment, her struggle and her leadership, her community have made the impossible possible. So the plan is to continue to do that, to utilize the courts. All of the congressional Democrats in Colorado have spoken out and called for her due process rights to be respected, as well as the mayor, the governor, as you mentioned. That's all because of the power that Jeanette has built over her organizing career and the connections that she has with other people. The courts may not save us, but we save each other. Only the people can save each other and make justice and democracy real. And that's what we'll continue to do into the future. We'll continue to have a presence at the detention center. We'll continue to support her family and their leadership. They're really the ones who are leading this fight.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Jennifer Piper, Program Director, American Friends Service Committee, Colorado, and Luna Baez Vizgueta, daughter of Jeanette Vizgueta. To see our interviews with Jeanette over the years, you can go to democracynow.org. Coming up, we look at the Trump administration's efforts to sabotage Social Security. Stay with us.
a man buys a house and the bank takes it away. A woman, you know, she works real hard, and yet the family grows deeper in debt each day. A child drops out of school, only trying to make it. Tattered cloth, bare feet. It's a bad bargain when nobody gains. Yeah, now.
Bad bargain by the Ohio Players. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Social Security Administration is considering drastic new, what they call anti-fraud measures that could disrupt benefit payments to millions of Americans. This is according to an internal memo first obtained by the political newsletter Popular Information, authored last week by Acting Deputy Social Security Administration Commissioner Doris Diaz. The changes proposed in the memo would force millions of customers to file claims in person at a field office rather than over the phone. According to the memo, customers applying for retirement and disability benefits would be required for the first time to verify their identity through an online system. If their identity can't be verified online, they would have to visit a field office in person. The memo estimates that 75,000 to 85,000 people per week would be diverted to field offices because of a large number of elderly and disabled adults do not have access to a computer or a smartphone and would be unable to complete the online identity verification requirement. The memo acknowledges the strain this would place on vulnerable populations and lists service disruption as well as legal challenges and congressional scrutiny among the risks of the proposed changes. A day before the memo was sent, the Washington Post reported Social Security Administration was considering ending telephone service for all claims under pressure from DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. Hours after the Washington Post report came out, the agency issued a press release claiming telephone services would not be eliminated. The proposed changes to Social Security come as DOGE is targeting the agency for staff cuts of more than 12%. We're talking about a lot of these offices being closed or severely limited in staffing, and yet a deluge of people would be forced to go to these satellite offices, some of them already closed. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Judd Legum. He is founder of the political newsletter Popular Information, which first reported the memo. Judd, lay it out for us. What are the threats to Social Security right now?
Well, one thing, Amy, that we know is that this is no longer a proposal. This is now happening. The Social Security office came out late yesterday with a press release and a news conference announcing that these changes were taking place. And there's a number of things that are happening, but the primary one that's of concern is that as Social Security closes down field offices, as they reduce the number of staff who is available to speak with people making claims, they are going to require tens of thousands of people weekly to come in to these offices. And the people that I'm speaking to at the Social Security Administration believe that this is an effort to break the organization, that there is no way, even at current staffing levels, for them to deal with this a number of influx of people into their offices, and that it will create chaos. And indeed, those implications are laid out in this memo itself, which I obtained and published earlier this week.
And Judd, what about this claim that that Elon Musk has made that as much as 10% of Social Security payments are fraudulent? What do you know about what the actual numbers are?
Yeah, there's no basis for that claim. The best estimates from the government is that 1% of payments are inappropriate, but those aren't necessarily payments that are related to fraud. It's generally payments that are related to either the government or individuals not updating their records. So what's happening here as well, and I think it's important to understand, is that this ID verification is they're imposing this at the time of people applying for a claim. And there are no benefits at the time of application. After you make that application for a claim, depending on the kind of claim, there are many steps that are already taken by Social Security to verify your identity. They'll look at pay stubs. They'll look at employment records. If it's a disability claim, they'll look at medical records. There's all these steps that are taken to verify that you are who you say you are and you are or are not entitled to the benefits that you're seeking. So the idea that this point, the point in which you're initiating a claim, is the point in which you need to impose this ID verification that requires people, many people, to come into the offices to fight fraud just doesn't make any sense because no benefits are being distributed at that point in the process anyway.
And I want to go back to this issue of the staffing levels with DOGE planning about 12% staff cut, about 7,000 employees. Yet Social Security staffing is at a 50-year low, exactly at the time when more people are on Social Security than ever before. And those numbers are bound to grow over the next couple of decades.
Yes, this was a problem. This predated the second Trump administration. I mean, this has been a problem, as you note, for many years. And actually, just beginning at the beginning of January, before the Trump administration was put into place, there was a new rule for Social Security that you could no longer drop in. You can no longer simply show up at a Social Security office. You have to make an appointment. And depending on where you live, though, there was a wait time on average of 30 days. That's the average. Of course, some people are waiting even longer than that. And so now we have a situation, then you're layering on top of this a significant staff cut. There's already been thousands of people who have left through the fork memo that was sent out, through other voluntary retirements. They're trying to cut about 7,000 in total. They're also closing dozens of these field offices. And that's very significant, too, because already, even before these closures, some people would have to travel 100 miles or more to get to their field office. It's not necessarily the case where it's around the corner. Of course, some people are lucky. There might be near a office they have to visit, but others are many, many miles away. And those commutes are going to be even longer. And what the memo mentions, somewhat elliptically, but I think is important, is that especially when you're talking with very elderly or disabled populations, there are people who simply cannot make it to the office, to these offices. They are not able to travel. And there's really no provisions laid out in this plan to accommodate those people.
Judd, before we go, I wanted to ask you about the newsletter Musk Watch that you run, which focuses our reporting on billionaire Elon Musk's wealth, power and influence. And last week you launched the Musk Watch Doge tracker to see what's being cut and who's being impacted. And Musk has gone after it as well. Talk about what you found.
Well, we really looked very closely at this website that Musk has put up and tried to see. He's claiming over $110 billion in savings. How much are actually itemized? Only about $30 billion. But then how much are verifiable? When you actually look at the actual primary sources, how much can you actually determine has been cut? And it's more around the range of $8 billion. So what we found is he is vastly overstating the number of cuts. That doesn't mean the cuts aren't devastating. If you're cutting a grant that's helping people avoid deadly diseases in abroad, that could have a big impact. But the size of these cuts is not something that's going to make any kind of impact on the deficit, at least at this point.
And Musk has attacked it?
Musk has attacked it, essentially saying that we were claiming he's not cutting enough. That's not what we're saying. But yes, I don't think he appreciates people taking a close look at his claims. But I think that's important. The website he set up really doesn't provide enough transparency. And so we've set up this this MuskWatch Doge tracker to try to really drill down. You can look at each individual cut. You can look at it by state. You can look at it by congressional district. You can see exactly how much in each grant that he is overstating the savings. So it's all right there for people to learn for themselves.
And we just have 5 seconds, but do you think they're attacking Social Security to privatize it?
I don't know exactly what the end goal here is, but I think they're, when you're looking at trying to get $1 trillion in savings, you've got to look at